got the captain's part.
Oh, does he?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what they did.
He doesn't seem shy every day. Oh my God, this is...
Isn't there more lighting in this room?
Yes.
I understand. That is definitely the jurisdictional problem.
Well, is this on the statute that provides for direct appeal in this case from the district court? And I know two sets of statutes.
One is, so what we'll do is, I guess, what? Hang these off.
Well, one.
Once you're up here speaking.
Well,
no, they're going to be there. Heck, how do we do this?
Well, to know each other, to create a problem, to provide, make a future, to provide steps to parallel. And then there's also direct appeal. Of course, holds federal statute unconstitutional in the United States. It's part of it. I know they made it. They well beyond. That's true.
Well, there's no statute. Yeah.
They keep that pretense, right? And then Jonathan was going to write an article, probably. He has a computer. Or is that you? You're going to do an article. They have the method that we can chat with our workers about half the time it's broken down. I would have been breaking out into cribs. Not very much. But conferences are being defective. I don't know why. Things like the center's right. And then, I mean, occasionally I would laugh. And I find I think they have passes, and I'm pretty sure this one is full of heads up out of cyberspace. Talk about my dad. Yeah. I'm sure it is. Oh, you did? Oh.
No.
So are we ready?
I love the
food. This is the show.
My wife constantly points out. No way. What if anything is for me to run?
Exactly. One
last thing. Are you going to be here?
Yeah.
Both my computers.
Maybe doing some kind of magic.
Stop it.
Bless you here.
Bless you here. Walk in publicly.
So are you ready to start?
You're right.
But that's another thing.
Do you know how many applications came in Monday morning? 47. It's the worst.
I think it would be better since they're recommendations and it would be well, you get the recommendation back to the faculty member and they tell you they're
not going to apply. That thing is working properly.
Okay.
That's true. There's no easy way to tell after what was done.
It also means that you had right. And last I had married many days.
So, call it ready?
Yep,
I should get out of the seat.
Your Honor?
Yes, sir.
Everybody.
Oh, we're going on.
You want to change it? Thank you.
Good evening, everyone. I think we're ready to begin. On behalf of this fall 99's Internet and Society class and MIT's Law and Ethics on the Electronic Frontier class, I'd like to welcome you to this year's annual Internet Society Moot Court, A Dangerous Net, the Nuremberg Files Appeal. This year should be really, really great because we have something a little bit different planned. We're going to begin with MIT students presenting for either side, so that should be a real treat for everyone. And I think we're ready to begin. Also, there's going to be a reception to follow on the first floor of Austin Hall as soon as this is over. So, all rise. The court is now in session. With the Chief Justice Stephen Williams presiding.
Thank you, Mr. Flexen. I'd like to begin our technical presentation with a slight background on the World Wide Web. What exactly is the World Wide Web? It's a universal information database paradigm that's internet-based. Through this web of computers, a user at one computer can access information that's present on another. The World Wide Web is significant today because it's based on the principle of universal readership. And I quote, "If information is available, then any authorized person should be able to access it from anywhere in the world." The system requirements to access the World Wide Web is minimal, so anyone can participate and benefit from this wealth of information.
And the World Wide Web is dominated by two traits. It's ubiquitous, meaning that it's simultaneously everywhere. Anyone can gain access to the net from any location as long as they have the proper equipment. So, for example, a site that's illegal in the United States can still be shown in a foreign country, and American internet users can gain access to the site. A classic example would be bestiality, which is illegal in the United States, but there's a site just across the border in Quebec called www.bestiality.com. Okay, similarly, websites can move and change very rapidly. Okay, it takes only a matter of minutes to create a website. For example, I found this site, which I consider a little bit dangerous considering that it asks men to beat me over the head and then do all sorts of bad things to me. And it took 9 minutes and 52 seconds for me to create an AngelFire account and create the content of the site and upload the files to the web. Now, that means that one man just sitting in his computer with not enough to do could create dozens of these sites in an afternoon. And imagine how many he could create if he didn't have to create new content for each site. It's astounding.
If I meant to ask our expert witness the question, can you explain to the bench what is an AngelFire account?
Okay, AngelFire is a web hosting service which has very thin user information requirements. You give your user information, which is never verified, and they host websites for free in return for showing advertising.
And just as a follow-up then, how would AngelFire compare to the defendant in this case, Greenspring.com?
It's fairly similar. In fact, I would say it's analogous. Okay, there are two information transfer dynamics at play in the world. There's the push dynamic and the pull dynamic. And the classic juxtaposition of push and pull is the difference between someone calling you at 7 o'clock p.m. while you're eating dinner to sell you lawn furniture versus your conscious decision to call a phone sex line for your own titillation. Okay. Examples of the push metaphor are shown there, the guy on the soapbox, television, and perhaps the most important example, the pull metaphor that we can discuss is a website. Now, this exhibit simply compares the World Wide Web to the library, acknowledging the similarities. Essentially, both of them are warehouses of information which can be retrieved for free. And both of them are generally not considered under distributor liability.
So as my partner mentioned, websites are pretty important to the entire realm of the World Wide Web. So exactly how do they work? Well, a server has some code in its directory. A client wants some information from that server, so they request code from that server. The server gives the code, and the client then translates that code to the requested information. Therefore, all the information the client needs in order to see the web page is cached on its own computer. So how do you make a mirror site? Well, it's quite simple to do. You copy code from the original server to a different one, and that's pretty much it. For instance, we create a mirror site of our expert witness testimony here. And we created one that's slightly different somewhere else. And to create these two mirror sites, it took us about 213 seconds. So I'd like to go into how internet service providers work, or ISPs.
Mr. Henson, before you go on, you said both of you have referred to how long it took you to do certain things. Does that reflect a significant amount of technical expertise, or could most users, I certainly would have no idea how to create a mirror site. So what section, how many people are we talking about who could do this quickly?
Well, I think that there wouldn't be a majority of the population, but we did do these times on the first time through that we ever have tried this kind of function. Therefore, a person who does this kind of thing many times obviously could do it much quicker. And
what was your major in MIT?
Computer science. Another person could do it much much slower. But I would say an average time is about what we have, if not a little bit slower.
Yeah, that would be the average time for someone who's a computer science major at an elite university.
Well, actually, as a point of reference, I'm a math major. I'm not a computer. I'm not a computer science major. I hate programming, and I rarely actually do any programming. And I created one of those sites, and I would say that, considering my general ignorance of HTML and how the web works, just using a simple commercially available tool, in fact, a freely available tool. The learning curve was nominal.
So you confess to ignorance about how the web works. You're the expert witness, right?
I confess ignorance to how to write an HTML page.
Does the ease of creating duplicates argue for or against ISP liability in a situation like this case? Or is it just an interesting factor in fact?
I think that's a very good question. May I refer that to my legal counsel to address later on? So I'd like to address how internet service providers work. Basically, a company establishes a public server that whose customers can access the web. The service includes internet access and website hosting services, and they're generally free because the costs of providing these services are generally offset by advertising revenue. The costs including the hardware and the personnel needed to maintain these websites and the internet access. These companies generally do not exercise discretion towards users because otherwise it would be difficult to guarantee no discrimination or censorship. So why do people use these ISPs? It provides a way for someone to speak in an international forum, and there's no unnecessary financial barriers. It also addresses freedom of speech. Everyone has a choice to voice their own opinions. So I'd like to talk about Brainspring.com, which is analogous to Mindspring.com. It approximately has 1.8 million users and 40,000 websites, which means it's one of the bigger ones out there. The user's policy, which all users who use the Brainspring.com, all 1.8 million users, agree to, says that the user is fully responsible for the use of the given services. And it also says the user agrees to conform to all applicable laws and regulations. Consequently, the ISP will not take any responsibility for comments posted on users' websites. It is not responsible for the consequences of its content, and they also promise not to remove the site from public domain on their own initiative, including when the user posts material that may infringe on another's rights.
Johansson, before you move on from that slide, if we could go back. You said that there's 40,000 websites approximately on yeah. brainspring.com, just to get an idea, how much information is that? Is that 40,000 pages of information?
Well, 40,000 websites is sort of a round number because it's constantly changing, with people adding websites, editing their own, and making their, and deleting their own. Therefore, I would say the average amount of, let's say, paper pages that this would take up would be a stack about 40 feet tall, all of 8.5 by 11 pieces of paper. But as I said, this is constantly changing, so it's not a set 40,000 page book.
Mr. Hansen, I don't know if you're going to speak specifically to the anonymity component to the user's policy at BrainSpring. If you are, I'll hold my question. If you aren't, I'll ask it now.
I was not going to address it.
So then I'd like to ask, there appears to be a policy of BrainSpring not to require identifying information before having somebody put a site up and make it available. Does that mean that an expert such as yourself with access to BrainSpring servers couldn't figure out, in fact, who had put up a site if the person putting up the site had wanted to remain anonymous?
I believe that there actually is a clause which says that a person may be traced to an actual email address, the email address that requested it. So say that it, I actually do address this later on, this aspect of it. But when they ask for information about when they open the website, it's not completely anonymous. They actually ask for a valid email address. And therefore, if you desire contact information, if it's not already available on the web and there's legally threatening material, they can refer you to the email address. And then, therefore, the server of the email address would be responsible for showing the identity.
And is every valid email address traceable to a person in the world somewhere?
I believe in order to confirm the website, you have to have had received information from that email account. Therefore, the website is not instantaneous upon giving any email address, but you must have actually had to have an email address to extract information from.
Let me ask again, is every email address traceable to a physical person in the world?
No.
Thank you.
So say BrainSpring receives a complaint on a website content. The complainant is encouraged by BrainSpring to directly contact the website author. After all, most web pages do include contact information. ISP may also review the web page for their own records. So what does it take to bring down a website? At BrainSpring, only one thing, legal intervention, such as a police or Department of Justice. No third-party complaint can bring down the website because there's no monitoring content and they're trying to avoid censorship. So why can't ISPs monitor the postings on their server? It's impractical. There's thousands of websites and there's an exorbitant amount of manpower needed to monitor them. If they were to use a computer thing, such as filtering device, it's not very adequate for triggering what pages might make a problem. For instance, breast could trigger chicken farming articles. And so also, how does one create non-discriminatory standards? It's almost impossible with websites. It's also unreasonable to ask ISPs to monitor their postings because it's a violation of freedom of speech. These are censoring mechanisms, and it's not always consistent. If they were to remove every page that had a complaint, they're violating the author's right to voice their opinion. It's also violating the service contract. Therefore, I want to conclude that the injunction is unreasonable. BrainSpring is not the only party that has the technical ability to modify these websites. The author does also. And the BrainSpring cannot control a website's existence. Mirror sites can be made instantaneously, and they can be put in other countries, such as two examples we have, one in the UK and one in Holland.
Questions? Okay. Couldn't they control whether or not they're participating in the posting of such a website? You can't prevent a mirror site, but you can certainly say I won't be a party to it.
Yes, you can.
Isn't the issue of impracticality really a question of economics? They simply don't want to spend the money.
No, because if they were to actually bring the site down, then there wouldn't be any resources going into providing that site for everyone who requests it.
I mean, your statement about it being impractical to monitor is not really an economic statement.
Perhaps. Can I refer that also to my legal counsel?
Sure.
All right. I'd like to go on with that slide. Back one. So I would say that the injunction is overbroad. What if the original ALA site of the BrainSpring server just reroutes the client to another server? And what if the original ALA site reroutes it to a similar one?
So we've talked about ISPs, we've talked about the internet, we've talked about the World Wide Web, but what we haven't talked about is the Nuremberg files, which is the crux of this case. Now, what is the Nuremberg Files? It's a list of doctors, clinic owners, and other proponents of abortion, and it lists their name and state. Now, it's framed in the context of an anti-abortion website, and I must say that the group that sponsors the website is rather inflammatory, but it's also a political action website. They look for information for future legal prosecution of abortion doctors. They encourage viewers to contact abortion doctors, and they include profiles of prominent abortion doctors to show who the leaders of their opposition are. Okay. But the Nuremberg Files at no point advocates violence toward abortion doctors. First of all, this website is under the pull metaphor, where the website must be actively sought. No commercial web browser will have the Nuremberg Files as the default start page, i.e. the first page that you will ever see using that web browser when you download it and install it. Okay. Moreover, in order to... May I see the website, please? In order to actually get to the list of doctors, you have to make a conscious effort to do so. Okay. You must scroll down the page and then click a link, reading through the content to find the appropriate link to find this list.
Question. Yes. I don't understand the relevance of that. I mean, if we're talking about something like pornography, and the harm we're worried about is someone inadvertently stumbling on material that he or she doesn't want to view, then what you're saying seems quite relevant in that context. But here, the harm is not that I, as an abortion doctor, might see my name on the hit list. The fact that I have to work hard to see my name is irrelevant. The point is that other people who have an incentive to find out who I am to harass my children can do so through the website. So the fact that it takes an effort, I just don't see how that that piece of technical information is related to how we should think about this website.
Well, in one respect, the fact that it does actually require conscious action on the part of the viewer means that it could never be put in a public situation where it just happened to pop up and instantly inspire a riot. As far as the legal relevance, I believe that's more the forte of the council.
Excuse me. What if the organization were to start distributing its own web browser that had as its default opening page this file? Certainly that's technically possible, isn't it?
It's possible, but it hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
To your knowledge, is there any information about the physicians on the site that the authors of the site wouldn't post?
Is there any information?
Yes. Is there any information that they have deemed not suitable for reposting once it has been submitted to them from somebody out in the world?
Well, presumably because they are making a very conscious effort to collect information, and because they don't have a public locker in which they display all the information that they currently have. In fact, on their first page, they have a statement that says, hey, we don't assume that we already have this information. Send it to us anyway. It's easier to filter duplicates. The reality is that on this page, all they're posting is the name of the doctor and the state in which he or she practices.
Well, according to, I guess this is the judge's finding of fact. No, I'm sorry, it's factual allegations, but I think they're... The spouse's names, children's schools, social security numbers, and car license plate numbers.
Are you just referring to this particular page that's being displayed right now, or do you also apply it to other pages on the site once a name is clicked upon?
Click on the name. Let's go down to Dr. Tiller. No. Scroll down.
What I was reading from is admitted in the answer.
Can I continue, Your Honor? All right, so another common misconception about the Nuremberg Files is that it is advocating the death of these doctors. What it actually is a news reporting service. It's saying, this is the list of doctors, this is our best list of doctors who practice abortion and the state in which they practice. This is their current health status.
Excuse me, what's the news value of the name of the children and the school that the children attend?
I believe that's in the eye of the beholder.
I see.
This is also public information which is available through the obituary section and through public announcements.
The obituaries? You mean for the doctors who were killed?
for the doctors who die, for and also the birth notifications when they have children. This has all been public information. I don't see how posting public information is necessarily wrong. May I continue? Okay, so this is effectively a news reporting service. Now, yes, they do format the doctor's names according to the health status of the doctor, but that's no different from the sports band that you'll see at the bottom of the TV during a football game.
Excuse me, I believe your time is up.
We address many of the issues that you were having questions about earlier, later on, actually. Is it possible that we may continue?
Your call, Chief Justice.
Maybe we should hear from the other side and then the law people and then see what technical questions seem to be up. So we will at least address the question.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Good evening, may it please the court. My name is Stuart Graver. Along with my co-counsel, Michael Siegel, we are representing Kelly Planned Parenting in this case. I'd like to introduce you our two technological experts. This is Gina Nichols and Sunil Rao of MIT. They'll be giving a presentation prior to the legal discussion of the issues involved.
Okay, I'll give my partner one moment to pull up our PowerPoint presentation. Okay. To begin and introduce the side of the case that we're presenting, I want to make brief reference to some of the backgrounds in the case, starting with the Planned Parenthood versus ACLA case, which for the purposes of this case right now, it basically says that threats in violation of FABE are not to be tolerated. And I'm going to give arguments why in this medium of the internet, the threats I was talking about in that case were the ones on the wanted posters. I'm going to give the argument as to why talking about these same threats communicated in the internet medium is no different than putting them on a poster. People should be held equally liable. To give you a little bit of background, first of all, I'm just going to explain what a web page is. Most of you know, I'm sure, but the idea is that there's digital information stored somewhere on a computer which can be accessed via the internet. Sometimes it can contain multimedia capabilities as well. It's not just static text or static information that can be displayed for the user. Another actor in this is Daniel Coast, who is the person who actually put the content of the Nuremberg Files webpage on a computer where it could be accessed by others. He is the original author, the originator of this content. Another player is Brainspring.com, the ISP involved, Internet Service Provider. To give a brief definition of that term, the Internet Service Provider provides the space, the digital space in which a web page, the digital information is stored, and provides access for the person posting that page and for others to access that page off the machine where it's stored. Okay. To begin the argument, I just want to state the three main points that we're going to make during the course of our discussion. The first is simply that the internet is an invasive and pervasive medium. This is an important point in the case.
It's pervasive, but I don't quite understand invasive.
I'm going to, if you'll allow me, Your Honor, I'm going to explain it in the next section. We are also going to state that the web encourages anonymous criminal actions and therefore requires some intervention by the court to prevent these sorts of activities. And we're going to argue that ISPs should be held liable for content because they have the power to remove illegal content, and they do more than just host this digital information. They provide very diverse services to the clients, and they profit from hosting popular content. And these issues are relevant to arguments that will be made by the council regarding ways that liability should be applied to the ISPs. Okay, Your Honor, to address the question of internet invasiveness, which I am arguing, I would just like to start by saying that the internet medium is one that currently is accessible to almost all Americans. Could you switch to the next slide, please? It's used regularly by many different groups of people. I have just some statistics for that. 40% of the United States citizens use the internet in the past year, and 22% use it regularly. Also, the average user accesses about 500 pages a month and about 30 pages per session. And just, you know, I obtained these statistics from Cyber Atlas, which is considered a reliable source of internet statistics on the web. Almost everyone is using the internet, including 43 million adults, 14 million children, and of all different races. And in fact, 51% of classrooms in 1998, not even now, were on the web. And that's from eMarketer, which is another generally considered to be a reliable source of information on the web. And the reason I mention these statistics is that use of the internet these days is not just a choice. It's something that people need to do for purposes of research, classwork, office work, and other functions of daily life. To some extent, it's thrust upon people in certain sectors, and individual pages are also thrust upon people.
Isn't just Jill's question just as pertinent to you? But it's hard to see how this is significant, where presumably the people who get access to it that we're concerned about are people with an undue readiness to assault other people. And they presumably are going to, if they're interested in the subject, are going to actively seek out this sort of site. Is the concern that from casual people who trip over this site, some of them will run out and start shooting positions?
No, Your Honor. I believe the issue at hand is that we're trying to make a case for why the internet in general is a medium that requires more regulation from the court than what has been provided to it so far. So while this is not necessarily immediately applicable to the issue of whether or not there is a threat on this particular web page, it is applicable to the issue of what kind of regulation the court needs to start applying to the medium.
Question?
Yes.
As we know from bank security camera videos, ski masks enable and support anonymous criminal behavior. One might also say they're pervasive in society. Should they be regulated?
Your Honor, I don't want to give a long answer to that, but it seems that that's a tool that can be used in a crime, but it's not a way of communicating or threatening another person. It's just something that somebody would use in perpetrating an act. It doesn't spread it, broadcast it to large groups of people. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't think I can provide a good answer to that question. Just to continue with my point about the internet, to say it briefly, a lot of the content of the internet isn't something we choose to view. It's something that is thrust upon us. We have no choice but to use the internet in certain contexts, especially as students or professionals. And when you do use the internet for a search, you do not necessarily get content that you are looking for. You might simply, people do not simply type in a web address and go where they were looking for. Anybody who's ever run a search to do research or to buy a plane ticket realizes that you often get sites that are not applicable to what you were interested in and often far off base. Also, links don't give you much information about what you're about to get. Before clicking on a link, you might be able to see what URL you're going to, but it doesn't tell you much about the site. And if you are going to get a page that you didn't want to see, there is little warning, especially with the speed of computers right now. And to address the point made by some of the judges, if you do warn somebody that they're about to receive a threat, it's still a threat if it's been so decided by the court. It doesn't alter the issue at hand. But to illustrate these points, first of all, I want to indicate, if you would, I'd like to indicate, show some of the ways that you can find the Nuremberg Files page in particular quite unintentionally. And if I can ask somebody, this is a list of some of the names contained on the page. Would you rather pick one? Okay. Would you please type in Allan, A-L-L-A-N, Jathu, J-A-T-H-O-O, and search for it on Netscape. J-A-T-H-O-O. Okay. If you scroll down, I'm sure there will be a reference. I didn't put in the full name, and that could get me in trouble. Would you add his middle name to that, which is Alvin, A-L-V-I-N?
While he's doing that, can you explain the relevance of searching for the precise person's name as a demonstration that I trip over this inadvertently?
The issue is, okay, if you were to, okay, if you were to look for a, say, your father, who, you were to try to find out where he was listed on the internet as an experiment, you might run across the Nuremberg Files page. I'm sorry, I'm killing some time, and so I'm going to try to speed this up. I'm going to go to the computer.
Actually, can we skip the demo and actually go back to the PowerPoint slides? Yeah, let's go ahead and do that. Trying to get through some of our content.
The next thing I'm going to show is the content page itself, which includes the names of many documents, it does include personal information, including addresses to certain links. The names are not separated from, completely from put together as areas of the webpage.
So let's go back to the PowerPoint slides. This is actually somewhat of an introduction to ISPs. There's a variety of levels of service that they can provide, and this is going to be a critical piece of information as we move forward with our legal arguments. First of all, an ISP could just provide a link to you, essentially a network connection, in which case you host the web server. Another configuration is where the content is just stored on the ISP server. And a separate scenario is which the ISP provides both the link and also allows you to host the content on their server. Next we're going to go into what type of a medium is the internet. So really the internet has evolved into something that encompasses all mediums. And additionally we'd like to take a look at, for instance, the fact that you can communicate instantly on the internet using internet chat requests, that IP telephony is coming into play, IP video, and for example, you know, in Reno versus ACLU, it was said communications over the internet do not invade an individual's home or appear on one's computer screen unbidden. Users seldom encounter content by accident. But that's not really true given that you have sites like Third Voice in which you can write graffiti on a web page. So inadvertent content is very much a part of the internet today.
Therefore, the push-pull characterization that was made, in which you must go out and request a web page, is really just an artificial distinction and doesn't apply. If we could take a look to address one of the judge's concerns about anonymous content, I've actually made a web page. I am the anonymous person here at a GeoCities account, in which case I filled out all incorrect information, an email address that was completely fabricated in addition, and if we can pull that up, it's at the bottom of the page. While she's pulling that up, essentially it sort of demonstrates the ease with which you can create anonymous content. If you can create anonymous threats, doesn't it make sense to hold the ISP liable and allow that threat to be taken down? Because if you don't, you just...
Suppose I did flyers, which were anonymous, and I hired a group of non-English speaking people to hand them out on Massachusetts Avenue, people who had no way of figuring out what was in the flyers, but wanted to earn the wage, should they be liable for defamation or assault or whatever responsibility the author of the message has?
So I'm not really sure about the hypothetical scenario.
Another anonymous communication, which we'll assume creates liability for the source of the information.
I see what you're saying.
It's used a channel, which in my case, my hypothetical, is not capable of screening.
So,
capable of screening with the current skill set that the people have. Now, they could go out and learn English.
So, in the case of the ISP, they're the only ones that can remove the content. There's no one else who can. In anonymous content...
If I've chosen these non-English speaking people to deliver my flyers, they would be the only one in that case who could remove it.
So, actually, I'm going to turn your question over. I just want to get through a bunch of the other content that's here.
I'll give you 30 seconds to get through the bunch of content because your time is up, and maybe we'll hear more at the end.
So one of the things I want to say is that what we decide here really matters because, for example, a recent event is a girl was killed on October 15th. Her name's Amy Boyer. Someone posted threats on GeoCities and Tripod website, which hosts content. And although it slightly differs from the case at hand, threats on the Internet are not protected speech, and they need to be taken down. And ISPs are the critical link in the whole equation, which unless we assess, you know, some liability towards them for, you know, and allow them to take down these sites, they'll persist, and there essentially won't be a rule of law on the Internet. So in summary, there have been some recent events which make threats on the Internet a question that really needs to be answered in terms of the liability for ISPs. We need to assess the liability for the ISP based upon the role that it plays. Does it financially benefit from the site? Is it just providing a link or is it storing content? The Internet is pervasive. You can search for various items and it will come up.
You have done double the extra time I,
sure.
I gave you.
Could you actually just pull up that website so we could take a
we'll now turn to the account.
Since the United set of experts has got all of their technical information in, you make sure both sides are going to be relying on that information as an evidentiary basis. The first is our continuing argument. Can we assume that the information has been admitted?
It can be filled in later if necessary.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court, my name is Gavin Clarkson. My co-counsel and I, Josh Fine, represent the appellants in this case. This case is actually pretty simple, even though the technology underlying it is rather complex. We basically have five issues to decide from the standpoint of ALA and Daniel Coast, and a couple more issues to decide from the standpoint of the ISP. But I'll be dealing with mostly the free speech arguments. And in this case, either free speech protections apply to internet content or they don't. The defendants believe that they do. Either free speech protections extend to those who value the lives of unborn children or they don't. Again, the defendants believe that they do. Either FABE restricts speech based on the beliefs of the speaker or it doesn't. The defendants believe that it does, and therefore it should be declared unconstitutional. A strict reading of FABE means that either the Nuremberg Files content constitutes a true threat or it doesn't. The defendants believe that the district court erred in finding that the content constituted a true threat. And finally, the injunction is either constitutional or it isn't.
What standard of review should we apply to the district court's finding that this was a threat?
I believe you'd have to apply a de novo review, since that's really going to be more a conclusion of law than a conclusion of fact as to what constitutes a true threat.
Do you have any authority for that?
Not at this time, Your Honor. Although the district court did say that there was a higher standard of review for issues regarding the First Amendment. So I would cite the district court's ruling in that regard.
That's usually not very helpful when the district court's decision is under review.
Well, I'm willing to accept their standard of review, Your Honor. But going on, what this appeal is not about, we're not going to try and sit up here and tell you whether abortion is wrong or not. The issue at hand is not the appropriate vehicle for that discussion. The primary issue at hand is free speech. And as this very court stated quite clearly in Bray versus Alexandria Women's Health Clinic, abortion rights are clearly much less explicitly protected by the Constitution than the right of free speech. Now, as to the free speech issue, free speech protections clearly extend to internet content, as this court emphasized in Reno versus ACLU.
Are you going to devote some time to the question whether there was a threat within the meaning of the statute?
Yes, Your Honor, I will.
Often one begins with the statutory question in order to avoid difficult constitutional questions.
Yes, Your Honor. But I will get to the issue of whether this constitutes a true threat or not. Most importantly, from this court standpoint, this court did make the differentiation in Reno versus ACLU between push and pull content, and clearly determined that websites were for remote information retrieval, obviously pulling information from a remote site. And our experts also gave you a clear distinction between push and pull content. As to the second issue, free speech protections clearly extend to those who value the lives of innocent unborn children, even if the government, the abortion industry, or even this court don't necessarily agree with what they say. They have the right to shock, they have the right to offend, and they even have the right to make the abortionists feel uneasy by painting a mental picture where the abortionists are forced to stand trial for their crimes against humanity and the millions of innocent children that they have allegedly slaughtered. But still, that speech, even as offensive and as much as you might disagree with it, it's still protected by the First Amendment. As this very court held in Brandenburg v. Ohio, speech is protected unless it incites imminent law's action. And the plaintiffs have conceded that if Brandenburg applies, a finding against the defendants because of their views would in fact violate the First Amendment. FABE restricts free speech based on the beliefs of the speaker, or in this case, on the beliefs of the website owner.
Counsel, I don't see anything in the statute that specifically refers to the beliefs of the people. It refers to the activity that they are potentially engaging in. And in that respect, I don't see how it's any different from the injunction that the Supreme Court has upheld, saying you can't approach people going into an abortion clinic. I mean, obviously, and the court recognized, this will mainly affect people trying to do anti-abortion counseling, but that did not make it violative of the First Amendment. How is this any different from what this court has said in the past regarding those forms of regulation?
Well, if Your Honor, if I might, I'll use the example of the mirror site presented by the expert witnesses for that exact example. If you look at the statute only applies if the activity is done because the person against whom the activity is directed is performing reproductive health services. So it's only because that the person is involved in reproductive health services. If you look at the mirror sites, which were put up by free speech advocates, both sets of free speech advocates themselves are pro-abortion. They have no problem with the provision of reproductive health services. They're only putting up the mirror sites simply because of their advocacy of free speech. and therefore FAVE would not apply to them, even though the website is word-for-word identical. So it is only because the FAVE can only be applied to the defendants because of their beliefs that abortion is wrong, simply because they put up this information because the abortion doctors are performing reproductive health services.
What in the statute gets you to that conclusion?
The word because is in there. It says that it's only prohibited because...
Because that person
is or has been in obtaining or providing reproductive health services. So the emphasis is on the word because, and that's what makes it content-based. Because the statute would not apply to the free speech member sites, even if they were hosted domestically, because they are not advocating a pro-life position.
What if Congress found that stores that sold furs were under incessant attack, sometimes with violence, and so because it was, attacks which were directed to the fact of selling furs, is it content-based to single out for punishment people who attack fur stores because the stores are selling furs?
Well, Your Honor, my answer
is simply identifying a special class of problem that seems to call for protection.
Well, Your Honor, in terms of what Congress actually did intend, if I refer you to my brief where I cite the legislative history, where Congress said that that FAVE would not apply to a group of environmental protesters or animal activists for it to...
No, I understand, because their motivation is not a common cause of this particular problem that Congress has identified. Same with my fur case, which suppose someone throws paint on Neiman Marcus because their prices are too high. That would be a different reason, not associated with what Congress has identified as a wave of attacks, and therefore not calling for any action.
I guess I'm not exactly sure what your question is, Your Honor.
Well, why is it content-based? Why is it content based restriction on a particular class of assault if Congress simply recognizes that there's a particular cause for the frequency of a particular type of building or place being assaulted? So it tries to focus on assaults that arise out of that cause. Is that content based?
It may be. Obviously, if there's a specific governmental interest, that's what might allow for content-based restriction. But in this case, there's no governmental interest necessarily there's no governmental interest forwarded by the fact that a mirror site can host the exact same content espousing the exact same message couched in terms of a free speech advocate. I'm not sure if that's an answer to your question.
I didn't see how it did, but perhaps on reflection,
okay.
Figure out how it did.
Well, Your Honor, because the mirror sites are not susceptible to attack by FABE, yet the original site was, that's our position about why it's attacking.
Isn't this somewhat a case of res ipsa? I mean, the words are there. They connote a threat or they don't. And if they connote a threat sitting there on a website, why would you need to intrude upon the intention of the person putting up the site to figure out whether the threat is there?
Well, perhaps if Your Honor could direct me to exactly what constituted the threat, what words
are the... Well, for example, if our clerk could pull up the Nuremberg Files site, I mean, here we shift into whether or not the district court erred in it being a threat, but I welcome the shift. If you'll scroll down, you'll see a line for Judy Ann Hanzo down the screen. Yep, it's before Tiller the Killer, two before. Then you click on Judy Ann Hanzo. Do you see it? All right, so there's her picture. And then if you scroll down a little bit, there is her date of birth, other information about her. Phone number, help, she's trying to hide. We need her latest number.
thanks for helping people understand there really is a payday someday. Now, if you were Judy-Ann Hanzo, do you think you could construe that as a threat, no matter who had put up the site?
Realistically, probably not, Your Honor, since I could find most of that information through other available sources electronically in about less than 10 minutes.
Yes, but every word on this page could be found in Webster's dictionary. Isn't it the way that they're arranged that connotes the threat?
Your Honor, the aggregation of information, I don't believe there is a case that says the aggregation of information constitutes a threat.
So you don't think that an animated GIF, which is just on the top of the screen, of dripping blood arranged next to the information, could shade it in a way? For instance, if I were to say right now, I'm going to kill you, it might have a different connotation than if I were to say it wielding something.
Your Honor, if you have a knife going at me, I believe I would constitute that as a threat. But, Your Honor, this...
But, in fact, even the words I say could be the threat rather than the knife, or at least could work together with the vision of the knife to make it a threat rather than a playful poke.
Except that, Your Honor, if I refer you to my brief in Lucera v. Troche, where on the Geraldo show, a Catholic priest sat right next to an abortion doctor and said, this doctor deserves to die. And the court found that that was not a threat.
Well, let me just point to one other piece on the site I'd like you to address. If you could jump back to the home page, and then just under Judy's name, you'll see this section is for information about butchers. And there are third trimester butchers. If you continue to scroll down, you'll eventually get to a letter to Dr. Ravi, which is a sample letter that people looking at the site are implored to send. And the last line here, right before the picture, says, even in a nation that has abandoned the law and substituted tyranny in its place, the law does not cease to operate. It merely takes on irregular forms and procedures. Stand up today and begin to help enforce the law in your community.
Your Honor, that statement would be analogous to the statement of the abolitionists in the last century who were protesting a practice which we all would agree was immoral and improper, and that would be slavery. Yet, at that point, it was legal, and so if they had been acting in that time to collect information about slave owners, slave traders, and such, to hopefully use at a time when those particular individuals might have been brought on trial, it would have been an exactly identical situation.
Question. You keep referring to collecting information. Databases are great for collecting information. What is the need of a web page? If the issue is to collect information to be used later, why is this public vehicle with its overtones being used?
It's being used to enlist more volunteers to collect additional information. It's advocating a political message, and there's no denying it's advocating a position, but it is not at all advocating a threat of any kind against any individual listed on the page. If I might just one other piece, none of the individuals that we've been describing here are named plaintiffs in the case. The named plaintiff nearly has their name listed along with their state.
Could it advocate a position without supplying details of the names and identities of the family members of these people?
I'm sure it could, but
So that part isn't necessarily has anything to do with advocating a position.
But their free speech rights still allow them to collect and present the publicly available information.
And that might change the tone of what they're presenting.
It might change the tone, it might make them uncomfortable, but it does not deny them the free speech protection.
But it might constitute a threat.
If the phone book would constitute a threat, if being able...
Back to the dictionary argument again.
If we pull up somebody's credit report, or we pull up have a private investigator pull up a background check, you'd probably find more information than you would find here. And again, the named plaintiffs only have their name and state.
Council, time is up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Seem to be no pending questions.
Good evening. May it please the court, my name is Joshua Fine and I represent Brainspring.com.
in this matter. I'd like to just begin by saying that Brainspring.com, my client, endorses and agrees with the arguments put forth by my co-counsel, Mr. Clarkson. However, should this court find that the contents of the Nuremberg website constitute a threat under FAVE and therefore warrant criminal sanctions, Brainspring.com, as the Internet service provider, cannot be held responsible or liable for those actions. It is the author of that content that would be held liable should this court find that there was a threat under FAVE. The Internet service provider, Brainspring.com, cannot be held liable for the action of its users.
There seem to be two models available, maybe there are more, but the two obvious models. One is the telephone company, for example, which is clearly not responsible if I pick up the phone and make a threat, engage in defamation, something like that. On the other hand, there's the newspaper, which is subject to a limited privilege. If it carries an op-ed piece with defamatory material, is going to be liable. So how are we to choose among these? Why do you think an ISP fits better in the telephone company model than in the newspaper model?
Okay, there are many reasons. First, this is what we see as the intent of Congress, where it has legislated in the area of holding ISPs liable for the content posted by its users. In the Communications Decency Act Section 230, which we concede because it applies only to civil actions and since technically FAVE is a criminal action, doesn't shield liability for the ISP, so it's not...
Are you conceding that although it's civil liability, that your client is has been found liable for that Section 230?
I'm just saying that, excuse me, I don't quite follow your question.
You seem to be saying that you were only invoking Section 230 by analogy.
Mm-hmm.
You don't rely on the...
I think that the language and the intent of CDA Section 230 does apply in this case, even though FAVE is technically a criminal statute.
Well, I don't understand that. It's a civil and criminal statute. It provides for fines and imprisonment, but also it provides for damages, and damages are what was awarded in this case.
So, exactly. Because FAVE has a civil component and the appellees are seeking civil remedy under the FAVE statute, CDA 230 should apply against the ISP. Mm-hmm. And CDA 230 contains in it congressional findings on what an ISP is and how an ISP should be treated. And Congress has determined that the Internet is offers a forum for a true diversity of political discourse, unique opportunities for cultural development, and myriad avenues for intellectual activity, and that the Internet has flourished to the benefit of all Americans with a minimum of government intervention. And that's
all that could be said of the press, though, right?
Except that the press has flourished
with liability, with publishers being liable for the defamatory and threatening, all that doesn't come up often, material that they choose to publish, authored by other people.
Right, exactly. But Congress has determined that ISPs should not be held to the publisher standard of liability. This was the finding, actually, in Zoran versus America Online, that CDA specifically says that publisher liability is not the standard of liability that should be applied to an ISP. And here's why. First, as our expert witnesses testified, an Internet service provider, a site like a network like Brainspring.com, has much more information on it than a newspaper would. A newspaper would have to read the content that the op-ed that someone wants to submit as an op-ed article and determine if that content is a threat or not. And
but if this is brought to Brainspring's attention, can't Brainspring respond to them?
If Brainspring.com were required to make a determination as to every website that was or every complaint that was brought to its attention, then BrainSpring's operating costs, BrainSpring would have to hire a huge staff of monitors and a legal staff and determine which websites are threatening and which aren't. And
isn't that argumentum ad disastrum? I mean, you know, cry me a river. So hire some lawyers or go out of business. I mean, the purpose isn't to keep you in business at any cost. The purpose is maybe to get rid of the threats.
And what you're saying is that this business doesn't have a good economic foundation if it's going to be run properly. Well, okay.
Except I'd actually disagree with Your Honors. I think that the purpose of CDA Section 230 is not to keep the Internet service providers in business, but it's to preserve the Internet as it is today, as a forum which offers a unique format for discourse. The Congress used the word unique. We don't want to make the Internet like a newspaper that's online. We want to make the Internet, and we want to keep the Internet, something that's different from the printed media. Some place where anybody can go and publish their content without censorship, without a company with money determining
so
if that is...
So suppose that Mr. Clarkson should lose, just suppose, and we find that these are threats and they are covered by the statute and the injunction is okay, and yet it sounds from the presentations earlier from the technical experts that because you don't check on the identity of people putting up sites, mm-hmm. and the sites go up pretty quickly, there's no way for this court or the court below to actually enforce the injunction because somebody could just anonymously put it up. We go to you and you say, don't blame me, we didn't speak it, then yet we have no idea who did it.
Okay, allow me to answer two responses to that point. The first is that even if we were to accept that concern, that is not what is at issue here because the actual authors of this content have been named and are sitting here in this courtroom. It's ALA and Daniel Coast are the authors.
But how many times does the horse have to leave the barn before you decide you're going to close the door? I mean, aren't there already mirror sites up with this thing?
Yes, so are you asking why... Can you restate your
question? Well, I took you to be saying that it was premature to consider doing an injunction against any version of the site from an anonymous source since one hasn't happened on BrainSpring yet. But must we really wait for that to happen and then gear up for another round of litigation, or can't we just be a little efficient?
I would caution the court to, in dicta, hold ISPs liable for anonymous posting when it seems that the clear momentum of our attitude towards the Internet, as evidenced in court decisions, congressional findings, is that ISPs should not be held liable for the content posted by their users. And the second point I wanted to make in your question, Mr. Justice Dittrain, is that anonymous speech is something that the Internet does allow, but it is also something that is the Internet should allow and that is valuable. In fact...
How about anonymous threats? Take the hard case. Presume it's a threat. I mean, is the threat protected by the First Amendment?
Well, as I said, if this court were to determine that that is a threat, that constitutes a threat under FABE, then if this is what the court determines, then that's what the court determines. But
and in that case, would an injunction lie against you, not just the defendants, to prevent you from allowing the threat to remain?
No, because our position is that by holding ISPs liable, even for anonymous threats, the result would be that anonymous speech would be curtailed. That as If I can point you to it was a Religious Technology Center talks about the chilling effects that would result in holding ISPs liable for the speech of their third party. The concept of chilling effects was first stated by this court in Gibson, where it was that the NAACP did not want to have to divulge its membership lists and because there was a value of being able to join that organization, although it was unpopular in Florida, being able to join that organization anonymously. And if one is no longer able to voice one's views, join an organization anonymously, that would have a chilling effect, and that would chill our speech.
Could you so,
would the publication of the Nuremberg files have a chilling effect on people? And if so, isn't that a problem, since you're telling us that a chilling effect is a bad thing?
Right. If we were to hold an internet service provider liable for the posting?
No, if we have the Nuremberg files posted,
right,
would they not have a chilling effect? And since you're arguing that a chilling effect is going to be avoided.
What I mean by a chilling effect is any court intervention that may infringe on...
You're saying people are allowed to chill each other all they want by calling each other baby butchers and your payday is going to come. But the minute the court says, by the way, this site can't stand there, now there are grave concerns about freedom of speech.
What I mean by a chilling effect is a restriction of free speech. If when a court decides to restrict free speech, which we acknowledge is not an absolute right, one must take into account the chilling effects that would have on similar speech or valid or valuable speech that would no longer exist because of the consequences of the ruling.
Is there a possible distinction under the statutes between the injunction and monetary liability? Section 230(e)(1)
mm-hmm.
says that it won't be construed to impair the enforcement of various things or any other federal criminal statute.
Okay.
Now, sometimes an injunction is used to enforce a criminal statute, while civil liability and monetary damages mm-hmm. seem quite separate. So is there, in terms of Justice Bittrain's question about how you would ever stamp out the anonymous source unless you can get the ISP, may not the answer be in terms of an injunction against the ISP without monetary liability?
As our opponents state, there probably wouldn't be any monetary liability, as they say in their brief, in a case of holding an ISP liable. So the question is the injunction. But let me just point you to the injunction of the district court. Court enjoined...
Counsel, your time is up. If there are questions, we'll perhaps give you a minute for a rebuttal.
Okay.
May it please the Court, Your Honors, my name is Michael Siegel, and along with my co-counsel, Stuart Grayworth, we represent the appellees in this case, Planned Parenting and Dr. Mike Niket. I will address the issue of ALA and Daniel Coates' liability under FABE. My co-counsel will address Brainspring.com, the ISP's liability, a few minutes later. Two findings are necessary to hold ALA and Daniel Coates liable under FABE. One, that the Nuremberg Files website constitutes a true threat to the well-being of appellants. And two, that ALA and Coast knowingly or intentionally interfered or intimidated providers of reproductive services. How do we know that they did that? Well, ALA and Daniel Coast are known advocates of violence against abortion providers. They unleashed the Nuremberg Files website into a known atmosphere of violence via the internet. The internet, the strongest medium of communication that is known to man today. Hundreds of millions of people can access this website.
Who is it that you envisage actually inflicting physical damage? Is it the Dr. or Mr. whatever it is, Coach, or henchmen of his, or is it independent persons? Or some third thing that I can't imagine.
Chief Justice Williams, for the purposes of FABE liability, it's not necessary to determine who will carry out
the threat. I think it may be, because at least as a matter of common language, I find it hard to say that if A incites B do something, B being a completely independent person, to say that A has threatened C, the victim. When Jefferson proposed that the Tree of Liberty should be watered with the blood of martyrs,
he wasn't going out there with a machete, right? Or
well, the Tree of Liberty was feeling quite scared.
it seems to me we have to decide who is going to do it or who is being invited to do it. If it's a henchman of the speaker, then that, or the speaker himself, then that sounds like what I would think of as a threat. If it's another person, then it's incitement. And I think we've got to put it in one box or the other.
Well, that's one of the dangers of the Internet and why the Internet needs...
Well, suppose this happened in the form of flyers. I'm not sure.
Well, unfortunately...
Wouldn't you have to put it in one or the other of those boxes?
Until the unfortunate incident that an abortion provider is attacked, we don't know who will carry out the threats. The threat...
Well, but as a matter of language... What is the language? Is the language rallying the troops to do something, or is it, I mean, specific people who are agents of the speaker, or is it a general call for outsiders? It could be both. It could be both. But where in the language do you see the threat, which seems to me has got to require the person speaking or someone acting under his direction.
As the district court found and the jury by special verdict also properly found, in light of FABE, a threat is determined on whether the recipient of the threat could reasonably determine that their life would be subject to bodily harm.
You're saying that in, as used in FABE, threat is a term of art, which means on the one hand, threat, as we use it normally, and incitement.
I'm not addressing the issue of actually whether threats or the number of Beisel will rise to the level of incitement under the Brandenburg line of cases. As other circuit courts have found, the Brandenburg line of incitement doesn't need to apply to FABE, especially because it proscribes threats.
I think that's correct, if it's a threat.
That's precisely the question. There could be a difference between what counts as a threat for purposes of FABE and what counts as a threat for purposes of what the Constitution permits, right? So you have the Brandenburg cases, but then you have this case, the case about the threat to the president, and that the true threat for constitutional purposes might be a different thing than what counts as a threat for the purpose of the statute.
Justice Jules,
that's what
precisely because we're dealing with the federal statute, we're dealing with the interpretation of threat as prescribed under the statute, as long as it's constitutionally permissible
right.
to regulate that threat. And what I'm arguing is that the statute in and of itself is constitutional.
Well, the question is it constitutional to permit this sort of incitement-type threat? Where is it constitutional to regulate that sort of threat, where it's not the responsible person is unclear?
Yes, and that's exactly what we're...
Why? What authority? Or
without satisfying the Brandenburg test.
Right.
Well, without addressing Brandenburg, because we are dealing with the Internet, which, if we want to go down a Brandenburg line, imminent lawless action that is likely to provoke such harm, well, I would argue that at least the second arm of the Brandenburg test is more satisfied by the Internet. But to go back to without focusing on the Brandenburg line of cases, a threat is in the eye of the victim. And I argue that because abortion providers, how did they react? Let's go back to the district court's findings of fact. These are people who changed their routes, wore bulletproof vests, wore disguises to escape. They felt threatened.
I think we can take it as conceded that these were made, the doctors were made nervous. But it may be important from a constitutional perspective whether they were made nervous by what they saw as the increased probability of an attack by someone other than the speaker.
I agree that the distinction under FABE between incitement to lawless action, which is a more strict standard than the actual threat, is a fine line and a fine distinction. But again, because we're dealing with the definition of threat under a federal statute. And if I may point you to the legislative history of the statute itself, the Senate and the House both attempted to define what is a true threat under FABE within constitutional permissibility. And I think that, as the brief points out, such a definition is fully consistent with traditional constitutional principles, and that regardless of whether a third party carries out the threat is not necessarily incitement, although it may rise to incitement, but a threat is still a threat even if it is carried out by a third party.
Are you saying that Congress can simply evade the Brandenburg test by characterizing conduct which seems to fall flatly within Brandenburg as being incitement, or potentially incitement, by saying that it's a threat? But no, 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 we're going after threats, so we don't have to worry about Brandenburg.
Chief Justice Williams, I agree with you. Congress cannot do that. What Congress did try to do is, by prescribing only force, threats of force, and physical obstruction, they're making a content-neutral regulation. They're not regulating the message. They're merely regulating three types of conduct that are prohibited within constitutional allowances. And again, when an abortion provider feels, or a reasonable person in the situation of a threat recipient would see that threat and must react in such a way.
Counsel, what's your best example of the conduct as expressed through the speech on the website that rises to the level of threat or incitement, whatever we're calling it here?
A threat must be examined in light of its entire factual context. Little parts of information may need not rise to the level of threat, but when you combine personal information, including children's schools, license plate numbers, social security number, and home addresses, with dripping blood images of pain and hurt.
Do we know whose blood is sought to be depicted?
I couldn't even imagine.
It's the blood of writers more than it is the blood of doctors. Yeah.
Right.
Well, I wouldn't suppose, or would not be my position to suppose what is in the minds of those who created the website, but the reaction and what appellants knowingly or intentionally desire to do is to interfere or to intimidate providers of reproductive services.
So, Mr. Siegel, let me ask the clerk to pull up a quick website. I'd like your view on this as to how it relates. If the clerk can pull up www.gsiweb.net and show it to everyone rather than just the clerk. And here we find ourselves on the homepage of the Alabama Department of Public Safety. There's a picture of the department with its Corinthian columns. And if you then click on sex offenders, and you see here a search box that will appear. And just click on the county search button. We'll be looking at Autauga County in the state. And you click on county search, and you see a list of names appear on the left. Let's just click on the first one, Alistair J. Hobson from Billingsley. And now we have a picture of Alistair pull up. There's his name, his race, his sex, his birthday, height, weight, eye color, hair color, his address, crime information. And then, look at the bottom, you can click to view a map of Alistair J. Hobson's approximate location. And if you click on that, a window pops up, and there in the crosshair appears his house. Now, isn't this a packaging of information that would perhaps incite somebody? If Alistair were to see this on the web, would he not perhaps fear that somebody would find him and try to hurt him?
Alistair himself may fear, but would a reasonable person in Alistair's situation also fear? That I don't know. Although, if you look at this website, the distinction here between this and the Nuremberg files is clear. There's no daggers intimating violence. There's no dripping blood from Alistair. There's no words or phrases indicating that Alistair has offended or has offended humanity, other than...
What's the crime?
In this case, the sex crime is rape second. And then some of the other names we find more descriptions, more vivid descriptions of the crime for each person.
The fact that he's been found guilty of a crime would suggest he has offended somebody.
He clearly, well, again, here's another distinction. The people on this website have violated the law. They've been found guilty in a court of law. No. Just to say, I disagree entirely in the sense that these are not people who are or feel that they're being threatened. The abortion providers, who Congress has realized are, there's a known atmosphere of violence against abortion providers, and that's why...
But there are no instances of violence against people who's have committed crimes of a particular sort, particularly sex offenders, whose public information is made known to the world at large. Their houses get burned down, they get attacked.
And that's unfortunate and wrong and illegal as well.
So again, I ask, is the state of Alabama similarly situated to the Nuremberg Files, in your view?
I'm not familiar if there's any statute prohibiting threats against known sex offenders. If Congress did decide that sex offenders were a class that needed special protection, much like abortion providers, and created a federal statute where sex offenders receive protection from threats, force of violence...
I was just curious whether, in your view, this rose to the level of a threat, and if it did, whether or not it's illegal, if it did rise to the level, if it did not rise to the level of threat, what makes...
I don't think that this rises to a level of threat.
I see. Okay.
And the difference is the dripping blood?
The dripping blood.
For one reason, it's the dripping blood. It may be the daggers. It may be the murdered colleagues with lines callously struck through their name like a checklist. None of those things are apparent here. And that's the factual distinctions when you look at the entire context of what is a threat. That's what makes the distinction. And that's why Alabama is not violating any federal statutes and is not rising to the level of threats. What the Nuremberg Files is. I see that my time is almost up, Your Honor, but if I may just close with the idea that free speech and the First Amendment is not in jeopardy here. What is in jeopardy is women, and their providers. And I thank you for the court's time.
Good evening. My name is Stuart Grawer. I am representing Planned Parenting against Brainspring.com in the matter of whether or not an internet service provider should be held liable for the content of one of its subscribers. There's two major issues in order to apply that type of liability to the internet service provider. First, is there some form of liability which will allow us under this particular statute to hold them legally responsible for the conduct of ALA and Daniel Coase? And secondly, if there is, should we apply that standard? I believe that the answer to both questions is yes. The first instance is whether or not FABE will allow us to provide a form of third-party liability against the Internet service provider. And I will admittedly concede from the beginning that FABE does not speak to this issue. It does not specifically say that third parties should be held liable. It doesn't talk about Internet service providers. It does not have an affirmative cause of action in this regard. However, that should not prevent this court from finding that there are standards of liability which should apply. There are two specific federal statutes that I've cited which are silent on the issue of third-party liability, the copyright statute and the trademark statute, which this court has in Sony and in Inwood applied a third-party standard of liability under either the doctrine of vicarious liability or contributory liability. Applying either one of those standards in this case, I think, is good policy and fits the legal justifications of those doctrines.
Counsel, can you just get out of the way right at the beginning this argument about the CDA and because to me that seems pretty clear that Congress has enacted a special immunization that's not present in copyright and these other contexts you mentioned, and it specifically said we want ISPs to be unencumbered and to, you know, all of the arguments that your opponent made.
Sure. I would think the first point when we talk about CDA 232 recognizes that this is the first time that how CDA 230 should be applied to Internet service providers is before this court. So in terms of reviewing the lower court decisions, I believe really it's a de novo standard of review. Secondly, we do have conflicting federal statutes at some level in this case. We have a FABE federal statute which prescribes conduct, these threats that we've been discussing against abortion doctors.
But you just conceded earlier that it doesn't say anything specific about third-party liability. Right. So there's no conflict between that and something which extinguishes liability or prevents liability from coming into existence for a specific class of third-party people.
Right. The CDA 230 does, however, have the exception that it's not meant to impair any enforcement of the criminal statutes. And if we're going to hold FABE to be a criminal statute, it is under the criminal code, then it perhaps falls under that section of the CDA 230 that is not addressing third-party liability in criminal cases. So,
but this is not a criminal case.
I mean, FABE is a criminal statute.
Well, it has, as I mentioned before, it has criminal and civil components, and this case was brought under a civil component.
Sure. My answer to that would be twofold. First is that when you look at the original reason why CDA 230 was enacted in terms of the reasons for the immunity provisions, I believe that they do not apply to this case. Originally, CDA 230 grew out of a case involving Prodigy Service, who's an Internet service provider. Prodigy attempted to effectuate one of Congress's main goals with the Internet, which is self-regulation by Internet service providers. In doing so, in trying to exercise some editorial content over the messages that were posted on their services, they actually got sued by one of the persons whose message was taken down. As a result of that action, Congress said, when ISPs are trying to self-regulate, we need to provide them immunity. Well, now what's happened is I believe a lot of lower courts have misinterpreted that. Now they've applied that immunity provision to Internet service providers even when they don't act. So that, in the case of Zarin versus America Online, which the appellants argue, the lower court has said even when you don't act, i.e. that there's an individual, Ken Zarin, who's been harmed, he's trying to get you to take down a posting against him, then the immunity applies to all third-party activity. I believe that that doesn't effectuate the goals of Congress in advancing self-regulation of the Internet.
Where in the language of statute do you find that distinction?
I find it in the policy of the statute.
Well, what about that? The language is quite broad. No provider or user of an interactive computer service shall be treated as the publisher or speaker of any information provided by another information content provider. That seems flat and broad and covers both of the cases that you're drawing a distinction between.
As I believe you suggested earlier, Chief Justice, there is a standard in the defamation cases, as you suggested, in terms of the publisher liability and the telephone case.
Yeah, well, hasn't Congress decided?
Right, but that specifically says publisher. There's also a standard in the defamation cases that talks about distributor liability, which doesn't seem to be, by the plain language of the statute, outlawed. In the distributor liability cases, as they've been applied to traditional media, there's been liability imposed on institutions such as bookstores when they're aware that the information contained within a particular publication that they're selling is liable or defamatory, and there's a requirement upon them upon receiving that knowledge to remove that, and if they don't, then they can be held liable. And I don't see.
So your claim is that the purpose of 230 was to put ISPs into the box that Chief Justice Williams alluded to earlier of distributor, not to put them into some new box of complete immunity.
I would agree that Internet service providers should not be put into a box for complete immunity. How we're going to characterize what type of liability we're going to hold them to in terms of how the defamation dichotomy is broken down in the past, I personally don't think that dichotomy in the defamation cases between distributor and publisher liability should be applied to the Internet for the very purpose that there is no publisher in the Internet. I think one of the great things about the Internet is that it allows anyone anywhere to be his own publisher. There, by setting up an account with someone such as Brainspring.com, I can communicate my message to millions of people anywhere in the world. in the context of the defamation and libel cases, if I'm an author of an article that's being published in the New York Times, the New York Times has the publisher liability standard applied to it. And then the particular bookstore that's selling the New York Times has the distributor standard of liability. That middleman, the publisher, who is responsible for the editorial content, is absent in the internet context. As such, I don't believe that the standard of distributor liability of the bookstore should be applied to ISP affiliates. I believe that should be something heightened more than that, recognizing, one, that there is no publisher on the internet, and two, that...
I thought you got out from under 230C1 by pointing to distributor liability. Now you seem to want to get out of that.
Right.
If you get out of that, aren't you back into 230C1? Where
well,
you want to be?
Where I'd like to be is in something that I think that's what's very interesting about this internet context is that what you have before you is the opportunity to establish a standard of liability for a particular medium that is yet untested by this court. And I don't think it's proper for us to apply the traditional standard of defamation necessarily to what in this case amounts to conduct under a federal statute.
But at least you're saying that we are free to find a middle zone maybe between publisher, that is short of publisher, but more than complete immunity, for which distributor is one example of
Absolutely.
A level for which CDA 230 doesn't apply, since at least we know that distributors can be held liable for speech that they distribute in very narrow circumstances, and yet are neither publishers nor speakers.
Absolutely. And I would think in this case, what we have is an internet service provider presented with specific facts showing them that there is conduct that is harmful. Now, I understand that is a legal question that this court is being asked to analyze, but these sorts of allegations under the current standard of distributor liability arise all the time. When a bookstore is presented by an individual who claims to be harmed or by his counsel saying you're hosting or you have in your possession a particular book which is defamatory, please take it down. And then the question becomes on that distributor, you know, is it defamatory, is it libelous? And those questions present themselves in current medium, and I believe that those questions should present themselves in the internet context. And in this case, where you not only had Planned Parenting suggesting to the internet service provider that the conduct at issue was harmful and potentially illegal, you also had the FBI coming in and saying, look, this poses a serious threat to the individuals who are listed on this. Perhaps you should take a look at it. The basis of liability that I would apply is not that BrainSpring went and took an investigation and said, no, we don't think it rises to this level of being illegal that you do. They didn't do anything. And that's the problem that I have with it.
What's wrong with using the injunction as the sole tool? In other words, to read 230C1 in a fairly natural way to eliminate civil liability in its normal sense, but to say that where in order to prevent something which is enjoinable as to the speaker has been identified, litigated, it is then legitimate for the injunction to be enforceable not only against the speaker, but against the ISP, following Lumley versus Guy.
Yeah, I would concede, obviously, that I would ask for injunctive relief to be applied against the internet service provider. But I would ask for more than that, and I think when you look at how 230C1 is phrased, it says that it's protection for Good Samaritan blocking and screening of offensive material, which necessarily connotes an immunity when internet service providers act to block or screen offensive material. In this case, BrainSpring did nothing. They didn't undertake any type of review when presented with specific facts suggesting a site which might be threatening and illegal. They didn't instigate any type of an investigation. And I don't believe that 230C1 provides immunity to an internet service provider when they don't do what the policy of the statute is to do, which is to self-regulate. And that's why I believe that not only is injunctive relief applicable.
Self-regulation turns out to be regulation by the courts after gone through your argument.
Sure. But I believe this is...
It's not like self-regulation.
Well, I believe this is why liability, that this court has the opportunity to change that. If we're willing to concede that liability is going to be imposed on internet service providers when they fail to act reasonably when presented with specific facts, then what you will have is internet service providers undertaking prior to the point of the courts getting involved some type of review when when there's illegal conduct shown to them. And the benefit of that is that in internet time versus judicial time, there's a huge amount of damages. If the internet service provider doesn't act to remove offensive material or illegal material when they're presented with it, and we wait for the courts to get involved, you're looking at years and years and years of the information being out there. In which case, the damages to people like Ken Zarin in the AOL, in the America Online case, or the doctors in this abortion case, their lives will never be satisfied by the court's ability to provide remedies. We need to have internet service providers provide.
But isn't the consequence of that the ISPs will just be as conservative as possible to protect themselves from liability, and then rely on Section 230 if anyone complains?
Sure. I think that is a concern, but I think that there are three factors which would mitigate against that concern. First, I think that the legal standard of liability should apply when internet service providers act in an unreasonable manner on either side of the spectrum, either when they fail to take reasonable steps to investigate potentially illegal conduct when presented with specific facts, or when they just get some anonymous accusation, hey, you're hosting a website that has illegal content on it, and they just take it down without taking any type of a reasonable investigation, so that the reasonable standard of action applies on both sides to the
other. What would the possible source of law be for holding the internet service provider liable for being too strict? I mean, in general, what law would that violate?
Well, I believe that CDA 230 says that they have to act in a reasonable manner when they're...
I'm sorry, which section? A lot of sections. Subsections.
I believe it's 230C2 talking about civil liability. Section A says that any action voluntarily taken in good faith to restrict the access.
That's one of the provisions saying providing for non-liability.
Right. Well, I'm saying that the...
You're saying it has negative pregnant, but everything else?
Sure. I'm saying that Congress...
If that's true, then it's not a reasonableness test. It's a bad faith test.
Sure. Then that's the standard. I would say when the internet service provider acts in bad faith on either side of the spectrum, when they either take down too quickly or fail to investigate when presented with specific facts, then that's when liability should be imposed. And so there's a legal incentive for them not to act in the conservative manner that might be suggested. The second reason I don't think that necessarily is the conservative action of taking down everything that's somewhat questionable is because of the marketplace. I mean, there's a market out there for consumers who want hosting services who will act in good faith and not just take down their website or their messages when someone just suggests randomly that it's defamatory or libelous or harmful under a statute like FABE, such that those internet service providers that act in the most good faith will be of the most value to consumers. And the marketplace will necessarily regulate which way the internet service providers go on the spectrum of being conservative or liberal and taking down material. And that is a benefit. I see my time is running out, so I would just like to conclude by saying this is the first time that this court has the case of an internet service provider and whether or not they should be held liable before it. There is CDA 230. There are lower court decisions. There are also federal statutes which have been shown to impose liability when a third party is not specifically mentioned in the statute. I don't think that is the difficult part for this court to consider. The difficult question is whether or not you should do that. And if we're going to provide any type of redress for anybody who's injured as a result of any type of speech or conduct that takes place over the internet, the only effective way to do that is to place it on internet service providers, because they're the only ones that can control the conduct, and they're the ones that benefit from it.
Can I ask you one more question? Could you speak to the distinction, or if you believe there should be a distinction, in the liability of the ISP with respect to completely anonymous speech as compared with identified speech?
Sure. I believe that this court has said, and I believe it to be true, that there is a significant value in anonymous speech. It allows people to be more forthright about their thoughts. It allows them to engage in discussions which normally may be inhibited when they have to identify themselves. I believe that any policy that this court seeks to impose on internet service providers should seek to uphold and preserve anonymous speech. If we're not going to place liability on internet service providers, and we still concede that we have to provide a remedy for people who are, that this court determines have been injured under whatever type of tort or federal statute, then we're going to have internet service providers maintain completely detailed and accurate information about all the people who post messages and websites on their services so that injured parties can go after the actual tortfeasors. And that eliminates anonymous speech. The alternative is a system in which injured parties have no remedies, either against ISPs or against those individuals, because we're trying to preserve anonymous speech on the Internet.
I think you answered a slightly different question about the value of anonymous speech. I'm looking for your recommendation as to whether the ISP's liability should be the same for the two cases, anonymous and identified.
For me, the ISP liability is irrelevant whether or not the speaker is identified or the speaker is anonymous.
That's the answer to the question. Thank you.
I reserved earlier the issue of whether the technical experts needed to be heard, and if there is some technical point that either side urgently feels we should be aware of, either side could take a minute to do that.
How much time do we have?
We'll give you a minute.
Okay, I'd just like to clarify a really quick point about this injunction that was given in the district court. It states that the appellant, the BrainSpring, is responsible for mirror websites that are created. BrainSpring cannot be any influential on these mirror websites because they're on other servers, they're in other countries and other jurisdictions. Just want to clear that point up. Thank you.
Okay.
And another point that bears on mentioning is that anyone has access to the private information of any human, of any other person in this country. Through an 800 number, through a number of web services, for a small fee, you can get the marital status, the alias history, the names of their children, all other information for a modest fee of $69.95 from battlead.com.
Is that a threat, Mr. Kramer?
And one more point I think is worth mentioning very quickly. These are a couple of sites on the that are also U.S. hosted. Some are illegal, some are advocating illegal activity. We have Lolita.com, nude pictures of preteen girls, which is apparently legal. May I just finish this laundry list? It's only three more things.
I feel like you're looking at banner ads.
If they're that amazing, yes.
Whitesonly.net, which is so rife with racial statements, it takes two bottles of my Lanta to go through the website, including a wife-beating page, and the North American Man Boy Love Association page.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The schedule calls for judges' deliberations and comments and audience questions. And I don't know, we can...
We had reserved 5 minutes.
You did? Oh, I'm sorry. All right, you reserved 5 minutes. We'll give you 5 minutes.
My colleague, Mr. Parks, will take 4 minutes.
I see, okay.
I apologize for not getting directly to the true threat issue, but I think Justice Zittrain, having pulled up the other site, elucidates exactly why the Nuremberg Files is not a true threat. If you go back to what our experts said about the difference between push and pull technology, the fact that that website, in the plaintiff's estimation, was not a threat is equally the same as for the Nuremberg sites. A pull metaphor site cannot communicate a threat to the victim. The victim, the purported victim, must allegedly go seek it out. It's like if I publish in my doctoral dissertation something threatening in the library, the victim has to go to the library to check it out to feel threatened.
Counsel, I cannot understate how much I disagree with that. I mean, I feel threatened even if I don't go visit the site. If, you know, I know from the newspaper or from my friends or I somehow find out that there's a site on there with my name on it and other people who've been killed with lines through it and so on, I feel incredibly threatened.
But you're on this...
And that seems totally... Clearly people feel threatened. So the only question is it unreasonable? And I don't see your argument at all there.
Well, Your Honor, this very court has said that emotional effects are not sufficient grounds to justify restrictions on free speech. And that was in the Hospital versus Jerry Falwell.
The point is that I can't be threatened unless I actually visit this site myself. And I just...
Well, under the statute, I cannot communicate the threat to you.
What is your basis for saying that?
That the technological distinction that this court has drawn between push and pull technologies, and the fact that web technology
is a pornography decision.
Your Honor, the information.
I used to be a Supreme Court law clerk before I became a judge, and I was actually a clerk that term. So I
well, Your Honor, if I might try it this way, every single case cited by the plaintiff arguing about what constituted a threat was uniformly limited to push technologies, whether it was Gilbert and Leverton in the use of the mail, whether it was Dinwiddie in the use of the bullhorn, or it was Keller in use of the television. Everything that they cited as constituting a threat simply constituted push technology. They never once cited anything remotely resembling pull technology.
Counsel, to be sure, if the threat were scrawled on a napkin and then tucked in the back pocket of the defendant, never to be seen again, I would agree that threat had not been conveyed to anybody. It would be the ultimate in pull technology for somebody to have to go get it. But surely a site that is on the net, available to hundreds of millions of people, featured, they have a list on the site of all the magazines in which the site has been featured, clearly at some point or another, since there was enough effort made for the plaintiff to bring the case to begin with, the plaintiff became aware of the threat. Now, is it just an idea of agency that somehow the threat got conveyed by Glamour magazine instead of by the site, and that's what makes it pull still and not push?
Well, I believe that also goes back to Chief Justice Williams' point about whether or not the threat is being communicated by the person who is anticipated to carry out the threat, or whether some nebulous third party who happens to stumble across the site is then intended to be the person who would actually be the threatening party.
Is the publication of the website intended to convey information to some people?
It is intended to convey information to some people. Is it intended to enlist additional people in collecting information for
And it is intended to convey information. That is its purpose.
But not
I.e., it is intended to convey the information there on the site. The notion that I have to go dig this out seems at odds with the very notion that it is in fact being put in a vehicle whose whole purpose is to disperse the information.
But the intended audience, Your Honor, is not the abortion doctor.
So a hypothetical question, counsel. Presuming there's a gathering of people in a room, and I say to the gathering of the people, I am going to kill President Clinton. President Clinton is not in the room. If I do that, and then somehow he catches word, perhaps from some tattletale in the room, that I said that, and it looked like I meant it when I said it, have I threatened the president?
Have you communicated the threat to the president?
Have I threatened the president?
You may have, Your Honor. That's a question I'd have to give a lot more thought to, in terms of exactly how it would fall in terms of this push and pull analogy, because the existence of a written piece of communication in and of itself does not necessarily constitute a threat. If you wrote it down and put it in your back pocket.
That's a very good hypothetical.
I would argue that what you write and put in your back pocket is protected by the First Amendment.
Doesn't the distinction between push and pull become a bit harder to make when you consider the system as a whole includes media such as Newsweek, which are pulling things so that they can push them?
Your Honor, if you restate the question one more time.
I'm trying to look at the system as a whole, considering both the web and the rest of the world, the media that are around it, and an enterprise like Newsweek, which may go exploring the web to look for things that look newsworthy, that it proceeds to then turn around and bring to the attention of the world. Doesn't this blur the distinction between a pull technology and a push technology, especially if the site seems to be especially designed to attract the attention of a Newsweek?
Your Honor, I would say that it's still, in terms of the way that this court has ruled in the past, this court in the ACLU v. Reno case determined that the web content is remote information retrieval. And therefore, I would feel that this court's opinions in the past clearly delineate the distinction between push and pull technology. And so the U.S. News and World Report, although they may pull content from all over, it remains a poll site in that I, as the website visitor, must go to their site in order to read their information.
Sounds like a poll spring gun, because it only fires when you stand in front of it. Somehow I didn't really shoot you.
Well, Your Honor, we obviously have to be very careful when we're playing with the First Amendment. And now I believe it one more minute for my co-counsel.
Just very quickly, I'd like to conclude this evening by saying that our opposing counsel has said that perhaps if we were to impose liability on Internet service providers for unedited content posted by subscribers, we would reach a world where Internet service providers, market forces, make Internet service providers reach an equilibrium where all the speech that is good is preserved and just that amount of speech that is threatening is prevented. Perhaps that may be what happens. We're still learning how to relate to and regulate this Internet. But what we do know now is that the Internet is a vital, a vibrant, and a valuable resource. That's what Congress has declared in CDA Section 230. We also know that courts have refrained from imposing liability in copyright infringement, in trademark infringement, in libel, in defamation to Internet service providers when those violations were committed by their users. And we know that Congress in CDA Section 230 carves out immunity from liability for all civil actions in CDA Section 230 and even for contributory infringement in the Digital Millennium.
Is it really immunity? I mean, is the word immunity anywhere in the provision?
In what provision?
Of CDA 230? You keep saying how it provides for immunity, but didn't your opponent point out that it's just talking about whether you can be treated as a publisher or a speaker?
Well, the point of CDA Section 230 is that Internet service providers shall not be held liable for...
That's funny, they didn't think to use the word immunity.
So that Congress...
Shall not be held liable.
Right, so Congress has declared that Internet service providers shall not be held liable for all civil actions in CDA Section 230 and even for contributory infringement of copyright in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. And President Clinton just recently, a couple months ago, signed that bill into law. So I just caution this court not to bring to a screeching halt what is the clear momentum of our Congress and our courts and our society in treating Internet service providers as mere intermediaries, not holding them liable for content posted by their users.
Well, I guess if that's the case, why does Brainstream feel it necessary to put in its user policy that users agree not to disseminate information that will threaten another individual?
Brainspring.
Is it good citizenship, or is it just a...
Excuse me?
Is it just good citizenship on the part of Brainspring, or is it...
Exactly. Brainspring.com is not interested in promulgating illegal activity, so it asks its users to refrain from such.
Thank you. Again, the case is submitted. as I say, the program calls for deliberations and comments, audience questions, and I'm urged by Justice and refreshments, and I'm urged by Justice Zittrain to telescope all of the deliberations, comments, and audience questions in one, and perhaps just Joel wants us to move straight on to the discussion. But open. I guess we'll take a poll section.
Yeah, we could do it. Well, we could do it justice by Ricky Lake too, and just see how, if they were on the bench, they would vote.
No, oh, that's interesting. Well, all right. So let's break it down into. And I think the most direct questions are: is there a threat? And if there is there ISP liability? We knew lots of others. Was there a threat?
We're not writing down names. Please go ahead and raise your hand.
Was there no threat? Threats have it. Should there be ISP liability? Hands for yes, there should. Hands for there should not be ISP liability.
Well, let the mob rule.
I actually have one very quick technical question.
Could Brainspring.com prevent the creation of mirror files? Is that technologically possible?
On Brainspring?
No, no, to prevent other people from creating mirror sites on others. Yeah. Anyway. Yes? Yeah. Thanks.
Oh, there's something there. Oh, I have to start?
I think I'm going to pass. So, yeah, why don't you go ahead?
As you may guess, I think it's a very hard and close case, hence the way the case was expressed. I don't know. I know enough to know that if my name were on that list, on that site, I'd feel very afraid. I wouldn't just feel distraught and upset and that my reputation were tarnished. I would feel afraid. I don't know if it would be a fear coming from the people who put up the site, or a fear that somebody who might see the site would be incited to hurt me. But yes, it would threaten me. Now, that's only part of the puzzle, I suppose. I deem myself a reasonable person, so ipso facto, reasonable people are threatened by this. But, you know, and then you still have to say, does it fall under the First Amendment or not? And you get into the Brandenburg and the threat distinction. So I don't know. I think the world may well be a better place without this. That's not very respectful of the current cases and statutes and constitutions there, but what it would take to bring that about, I would care to investigate, without, of course, trying to sweep in a bunch of other stuff that merely offends. I mean, you know, for Jerry Falwell to be upset that he's pictured in Penthouse, you know, saying that his mom was in an outhouse or something, I forget exactly what the libelous thing was, you know, you wouldn't want to sweep that in too. So it'd be a careful line you try to draw with a scalpel. On the ISP liability, I actually would be concerned about anonymous versus not anonymous. If it's not anonymous, then you've at least got somebody to pin the real tail onto. You've got the donkey. If you have it as anonymous, it does seem strange to me that the ISP can say, we have actively contributed to the cleansing of any identifiable information from this, and now we're not the publishers of it, we're just putting it up on the behest of unknowns. It's as if somebody's attorney went and said, here, I'm putting this all around, but I'm not letting you know who it is, and I'm not liable. That, to me, doesn't wash so well, at least in this case. Right. You don't necessarily require that the ISP, you know, get the records, but you do say if you don't get the records, you stand in their stead. That allows anonymous speech. It just still has some measure of accountability.
Do you want to take a position?
Oh, come on. I just took a position.
You did it so well that you may have silenced the phone.
Yeah. Well, I think there's a threat in the English meaning of threat. I'm not exactly sure what liability that implies, but I do think that there was a threat. On the question of ISP liability, I think the ISP should not be liable, although of course should have to respond to an injunction to take it down. And I'm extremely torn at in thinking about what would happen if it were anonymous. I just don't know.
I basically agree with that, what Hal said. Again, I'm, as he was, talking from my own technical perspective rather than any sophisticated understanding of the legal criteria, but that's the way I would come down.
I mean, to take a completely different tack, I observed that this is supposed to be a section of judges' deliberations and comments. All of these things have been deliberations, so I will interject a comment. It seemed I was a little bit disappointed to find what seemed to be a disconnect between the technical discussions and the legal discussions. I couldn't find any connection between them at all. In fact, the technical discussions went on about things such as how fast it was possible to create a site and whether or not it was easy or hard to make mirror sites and other kinds of things like this. And the legal arguments did not pick up on this at all, apparently because it didn't have any relevance to the legal arguments. At least that's the conclusion that I have to come to. And I find that a little bit just disappointing in some sense. I think there might have been some opportunities for some significant connections to be made. For example, an argument that appeared, I believe, in the brief about the existence of mirror sites makes it impossible to create an effective remedy. That argument wasn't picked up anywhere along the line, and that seems to me may have quite a bit of relevance to the outcome of the case. Similarly, questions about whether or not an internet carrier, an ISP, represents a common carrier or not. It takes on off into a slightly different area of the law, but still seems relevant to this kind of case. So I stand back and remain completely puzzled by the difficulty of the case and instead focus on some of these what might be considered side issues.
No, I thought it was very enjoyable, and I learned a lot. And I came away, as I almost always do, from oral argument with a more complex view of the problem. Thank you. So I think we're on to the reception.
Yes, and we owe a round of applause to all the participants who put this together. And to McCall and Jalila for putting together the case itself. And Ben and Becca for orchestrating the table over here. And Alex McGillivray for helping as well. So. And now let's see.
What are you doing here?